Hi, this is Aaron from Gangland Wire. You're going to want to join me and Gary Jenkins for the 2018 Mob Summit in Las Vegas. That's right, folks. Las Vegas, baby. We're going to be there June 15th, 16th, and 17th. Three crime-filled days with author Frank Culotta. Gary Jenkins is going to be there as well, speaking about his app, talking about his movie, sharing his book, Leaving Vegas. And then Larry Henry of the Mafia Chronicles is going to be there as well, and many, many more. We're spending Friday evening mixing with the mob at the Plaza Hotel. Saturday from 9 to 1, we're in panel discussions about the mob. Saturday night, we're going to be rubbing elbows at the Mob Museum, and it continues Sunday from 9 to 1 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, baby. It's the 2018 Mob Summit.
This is Keith Giamacco, also known as the Boonie Hat Bandit, and you are listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective, produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City, staring at our city flag of Chicago. Thank you, Ben from Chicago. With my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, we are here tonight once again on a telephone interview with a true crime author and a little different subject. You know, we've done a lot in Chicago. We've done a lot on Kansas City, of course, which is where we're located out of. We've done a lot on Las Vegas. We have not done anything on the South Florida mob world, and we know that there was a complete family down there, the Santo Traficante family, but there's a lot more to it than that, and also the New Jersey mob. We've not really gone delved into New Jersey, a little bit in New York, Murder Incorporated, and some of the usual kind of suspects in New York, but we've not really gone down in and talked about the New Jersey mob. So tonight we have an expert on those subjects. We have on the line here Scott M. Dice. I hope I pronounced that right, Scott.
Yep, close. Yep.
Welcome, Scott. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here. I appreciate you guys asking me to come on.
Oh, and one other thing. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Scott, that's a little deal that we get started doing it. But when I have a telephone guest, I often forget. I'll have to cut that out and then plug him back.
Actually, you did tell me to say hello, and I just had a kind of a frog in my throat.
Oh, okay.
It's a little early here for me, but
now I've got a whole bunch of editing to do at the start of this thing. Oh, well. Anyhow, I'm moving right along. Scott, you know, I got onto you via Facebook and your books, and especially this complete history of the Tampa underworld, and I started looking you up, and you've got quite a history of writing on organized crime, particularly in South Florida, and then on farther north, you've got a couple of books on the northern part of the United States. I'm going to run through these books. Correct me if I missed anything. Your most recent book, which is on pre-release right now, Garden State Gangland, The Rise of the Mob in New Jersey, Cigar City Mafia, A Complete History of the Tampa Underworld, The Silent Don, The World of Santo Traficante Jr., and Rogue Mobster, The Story of Mark Silverman and the New England Mafia. Is that a complete chronology, or not chronology, but a complete bibliography of your books?
I got two more on there, too. I wrote a book with a former Florida law enforcement officer called Balls about an individual named Eddie Trasher, who was active actually out in Vegas for a number of years and in Tampa. And also Cocktail Noir, which is a kind of a bar table book with tons of cocktail recipes, and it's favorite drinks of gangsters and crime writers and old cinematic gangster movies.
Interesting. Now, you can find more information about these on your website. You want to tell folks that it may be easier for you to tell folks exactly how they can get hold of you, how they can find your work.
Sure. It's scottdicci.com. So that's scottdicci.com. I'm on Twitter at scottyyz. And you can look up Scott Tichy on Facebook. I have an author page on Facebook as well.
I think I tweeted something out about the Jersey Mob because your book about the Garden State.
Did you tag him on it?
I did tag you on it. Did you want to tell people your Twitter?
Oh, he did tell it. He did say
did
it.
Did he?
At Scotty YYZ or Scott YYZ.
Yep, Scott YYZ. Yep.
Got like one set on my headphones.
Listen up, Aaron. Listen up. Anyhow. you know, that cocktail noir, that sounds kind of interesting for those drinkers out here. You, tell me a little bit about that. That's, it's not exactly mob history, but yet it is too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it's a kind of a bar table book. So I talk a little bit about the history of some of the, you know, the classic pre-prohibition era cocktails, talk about how cocktails were important in old mob and film noir movies. I interviewed a number of gangsters and some people in law enforcement about what they like to drink, lots of recipes of cocktails. So it's a neat little book for people that are interested in the subject of gangsters as well as cocktails. So it was definitely the most fun researching I've had to do with writing a book.
Really?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. I see on your website now, I like this. And I think I may even remember this. When I was younger, I was a huge Mike Hammer fan. There's a real well-known movie and book called Kiss Me Deadly about a fictional, he's a South Florida private eye, wasn't he, Mike Hammer?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Mike Hammer's had a bad day. He goes into a bar and says, give me a bourbon and leave the bottle.
Yep.
Now, you don't need to know any more than that about Mike Hammer on that particular day. So let's talk a little bit let's start with Florida. You have this book, The Cigar City Mafia, a complete history of the Tampa underworld and the silent Don, the world of the Santo Traficante Jr. Kind of enlighten me and Aaron and our listeners about that South Florida mafia. How is that, a little bit of the history, and how's that made up?
A lot of people think about Florida. They think of organized crime. They think of Miami. Tampa area on the west coast of Florida had a homegrown mafia family that originated back in the early 1900s in an area called Ybor City, which was home to most of the cigar industry in the Tampa area. And it was an interesting ethnic neighborhood for a southern city at that time. It was Cuban, Spanish, Sicilian primarily, a small German and Jewish population as well. And they were all in this ethnic neighborhood called Ybor City. And out of that rose some of the early Black Hand activities that you see in a lot of the other immigrant communities around that time in the early 20th century. But with the advent of Prohibition, the Tampa Bay area, especially Tampa Bay, the body of water proper, was a huge sheltered natural harbor. And you had this tie between the residents of Ybor City and the island of Cuba. And you start seeing a large-scale importation of rum, of corn sugar, of molasses, of narcotics out of Cuba. And that's what started giving the rise to the emergence of organized crime in Tampa. And there was a Sicilian group in Tampa at that time that took advantage of it. There was a war, as there was in many of the other cities, for control of these rackets. The big mob boss in Tampa at that time was a guy named Charlie Wall, and he went up against the Sicilians. And then, long story short, by the early 1940s, Santo Traficante Sr. Kind of takes control of organized crime in Tampa. And from that point on, the Tampa Mafia become the dominant organized crime group in Tampa. And they do have very close ties, actually, with Kansas City, especially in the 30s and 40s. There were a couple of drug operations that were between Kansas City and Tampa at that time. Guy Nick DeSimone and James Impostato were gunmen that were arrested here in Tampa during this mob war, and they were out of Kansas City. So there were a lot of ties in between Tampa and other parts of the country as well. And, you know, what is similar in areas like Chicago and New York is you see the emergence of this national kind of coherence between these organized crime groups, and Tampa was certainly right there in the mix.
Interesting. What year was that those two Kansas cities? I have some vague memory of those names. What year was that?
Late 30s, early 1940s.
Okay.
This is the time period we're looking at there. Yeah.
So they would have been gunmen for Kansas City down there in the during the 30s. John Lazy was our mob boss, and he was killed, and Bonaggio, Charlie Bonaggio and Charlie Gargatta kind of took it over during that time. Charlie Carollo, there was three of them or so, especially during, this was after Prohibition. And there's a famous picture of Bonaggio and maybe Lazy too with their girlfriends down in Havana. So they were in the 30s, they were already going to Havana out of Kansas City to party and gamble.
Yeah. I do want to make a correction. I got the names mixed up. It's Niccolo Impostato and James DeSimone. Flip-flopped the first names. Right. Those were the two guys. Yeah.
And it's a DeSimone name. I remember that family name here in Kansas City. Well, interesting. So they kind of developed as a part of the, and the normal was their black hand in say Tampa and the area, and then kind of developed on into the 30s because of Prohibition, and Santo Traficante then rose up to the top to develop in the normal kind of way that we've seen the rest of the United States.
Yeah, but very similar. There were a few bosses before Traficante. The first one was a guy named Ignacio Italiano, and he was actually arrested in 1928 in Cleveland with Joe Profaci and some other bootleggers. But it's very similar to the way it progressed in some of the other cities. There was you know, some wars for control of the rackets. There was some internal dissension, but you know, Tampa, probably similar to the way Kansas City is, was always a fairly small family. So, you know, it certainly was never the size of Chicago or New York or any of those larger families.
I'm just looking at the Wikipedia about the Tampa underworld and the history, and it's talking about Ignacio. And basically that there was a war going on for a number, 10 years, it says, between him and Wall that weakened them both enough that Traficante, is that right, Traficante,
right,
was able to come in.
Yeah, so, you know, you had a little bit of a power vacuum there. And what's interesting about Tampa, and more so than any other city, is the role of Cuban and Spanish operators in that. And although they were never considered kind of the internal part of the mafia itself, being, you know, a Sicilian organization, there were very powerful Cuban and Spanish operators that were closely aligned with Traficante at that time as well. So it was certainly an interesting ethnic mix, different probably than any other city in the country at that time as well.
And in regards to Cuba, particularly in the 30s and then on up during the war, when Meyer Lansky and the New York mob wanted to establish casinos down in Cuba, in Havana, did Traficante have any piece of that action? I mean, they surely had to maybe not ask his help or may not ask his permission, but they probably brought him in on that, didn't they?
The Tampa mob's involvement in Cuba actually goes back before that, starting in the 1930s under Ignacio Antonori, who was boss from about 1930 to 1940. And actually, when Cuban President Machado left Cuba, he actually went through Tampa and stayed at Antonori's house. So the Tampa mob had an imprint, they had investments in Cuba going back into the 1930s. What's interesting is, you know, Meyer Lansky really becomes kind of a dominant figure because of the backing of New York being a much bigger crime family. And you had, like you said, Kansas City was there, New England was there, Pittsburgh, the Manorino brothers were there. Everyone was down in Cuba. But Santo Traficante Sr. and then Santo Jr., who took over in about 1950, they really had an advantage that none of these other mobsters had. And it was kind of a simple pragmatic advantage is that they spoke fluent Spanish because the neighborhood they grew up in, Ybor City, they spoke Spanish, English, and Italian. In fact, there's a newspaper that's still in print today, La Gazzetta, that's in English, Spanish, and Italian. So because they, the Traficantes and the Tampa mobsters, had that knowledge of Spanish that, you know, Meyer Lansky and someone growing up on the Lower East Side at that time didn't, they were able to get a lot of favor with the political establishment during that time, and then when Batista came to power. So by the time we're looking at the early 1950s and the real heyday of that era of Havana, Santo Traficante is right there next to Meyer Lansky as the dominant crime figure there operating in Havana.
Traficante, and they would know the culture too, growing up alongside other Cubans, so they could send their gangsters down there and move in and around the culture and kind of know, you know, who what buttons to press and who to contact and government positions to get what they wanted. I would have, and sound like Cuba was a little bit like maybe Vegas was back then, kind of an open city, until there was some agreement that, some particular family, had the dominant hand. You know, in Las Vegas, they agreed that the Midwest families would have the dominant hand in Las Vegas and the, Eastern families would have Atlantic City. Cuba was kind of open for everybody. Tampa definitely had to be part of anything that happened down there.
Yeah. There were a lot of people that lived in Tampa that, especially young guys, would go over and work the casinos. I interviewed a few of them for my book, guys that worked for Lansky at the Riviera. And, you know, a flight from Tampa to Havana now is the same as then. It's like less than an hour flight. So, you know, it was very common for people to go there for the weekend and party. You made a great comparison, much like Vegas.
Yeah, interesting. It's we don't really think about that. It seems so far, you know, and it's so distant, mainly because nobody's been able to go to Cuba for a long time also. And it just seems like a whole nother world. But back then it was almost like, you know, Puerto Rico was to the United States. People were just flogging in and out of Cuba all the time.
Yeah.
Well, there wasn't legal gambling necessarily in Tampa. Right.
Yeah. There's no legal gambling in the United States, basically on the East Coast. So, but there was legal gambling in Cuba.
Yeah. Not only that, you're there operating your businesses without, you know, American law enforcement looking over your shoulder, working with a friendly government, certainly during the Batista regime. So, you know, that is even taken into account as they really saw this. A lot of mobsters and people I've talked to that were working, as you know, they obviously didn't see it ending in 1959. They saw this as, you know, continuing to grow and prosper for decades to come.
Yeah. What about the narcotics trade? A lot of heroin. The United States mobs were involved in heroin out of the Mideast through Italy and France. And did they send any of that up through Cuba? Was there any action along those lines?
Yeah, there was a lot of narcotics coming through, using Cuba as a way station. By the 1920s, Tampa was a significant port of entry for heroin. A lot of it was being shipped up that Midwest pipeline. By the 30s, the Antonoris and the Kansas City family, guys from Chicago, had a Midwest pipeline going up from the Gulf Coast of the United States. New Orleans, too, was involved with that. So, yeah, Cuba definitely was a way station, one of the kind of ports of entry into the United States through South Florida, both Miami and Tampa. Although, you know, Miami at that time wasn't quite the player as it becomes in the 1950s, but that still is where a lot of those drugs are coming in.
Well, so Santo Traficante Sr. had a son who he worked with, and I'm just reading here on Wikipedia, and it basically says that things changed a little bit for him, if you will, just to kind of shorthand it, at the Kiefhofer hearing, where it says Charlie Wall testified in 1950, and then both of them fled to Cuba.
Yeah, when the Kiefhofer Commission came to Tampa in December of 1950, Charlie Wall actually testified in front of them. You know, if you read the testimony, he really basically rehashed a lot of the old history that happened, you know, 20 years prior. At that time, he had been kind of pushed out of the rackets for about a decade. And the Traficantes, Salvatore Italiano, and some of the other, the Antonori, the Detridus, I should say, they kind of fled and avoided the congressional subpoenas. But Charlie Wall actually, he appeared before the Kiefhofer Commission. What was interesting is that Charlie Wall lived for another 5 years, and there was always kind of a theory that Santo Traficante Sr., even though he gave power over to his son Santo Jr. Because of advancing age and illness, kind of protected Charlie Wall from any retribution from the Kiefhofer hearings. But less than a year after he died, Charlie Wall was killed in his house. It's one of the big unsolved mysteries of Tampa. But the thought was that now that Santo Traficante Sr. died, they were getting Charlie Wall back. One of the theories is they were getting him back for testifying in front of the Kiefhofer Commission. A little nod to that is when Charlie Wall's wife found his body with his throat cut and his head bashed in the back of their house, Charlie Wall had a book on the nightstand that he was reading, and it was Kiefhofer's book, Crime in America.
Well, it's always good to keep up on the competition, I say.
We better put a note down there because we might want to get a copy of that book. See, what that sounds like some good reading.
In modern times, it's probably kind of boring reading, but yeah, there would be a lot of details in there.
Is it thick enough to stop a bullet, really? That's the question.
I can assure you it's going to be thick enough to stop a bullet. A book with that title is going to be thick enough, thicker than you want.
It didn't stop getting his throat cut. But.
No. Well, that's as they developed on into modern times. Now, remind me, Scott, were they represented at the 1957 mob meeting up in upstate New York at Apalachin?
Yes, Santo Traficante Jr. was represented there at Apalachin. He was arrested. He gave the alias of Louis Santos with an address in Havana, Cuba. but he was at Apalachin.
Pass himself as a Cuban.
And I kind of always use it. Yeah, I always kind of use that as a good bellwether when I'm reading books that talk about Traficante, is whether they've done enough research to even get his first name right, because you see it Santos a lot with the S, and you know, obviously that's where that came out of, was when he was arrested at Apalachin. And he was also subpoenaed about the Anastasia hit. A lot of people don't know that he was staying at the Park Sheridan Hotel and checked out the morning of Anastasia's killing, which was at the barbershop there at the same hotel. So there was a lot of suspicion that Traficante might have known that was coming. And one of the theories for Anastasia's killing was he had met with Traficante a couple nights prior, and Anastasia wanted to get a bigger piece of the Cuba pie. Traficante and other mob bosses weren't so eager to let him in. So Traficante, like the mid-1950s, really started showing up a lot in the newspapers too, which is interesting because prior to that, he wasn't really named that much in outside of the local Tampa papers, but now his name starts becoming, you know, familiar. You know, you see it in the New York Times and other places where, you know, just a few years prior, he was really kind of just known locally.
Yeah, that I tell you, that Apalachin meeting bust up, and of course, stirred the FBI, stirred J. Edgar Hoover to start what he called the Top Hoodlum Program in most of the major cities where there was an organized crime presence. And everybody in the press particularly started paying more attention to these organized crime families after that. It really made a huge difference. And they can't, you know, they can't operate with too much scrutiny going on. So once again, you know, that opening up their names and showing that there is an organization really damaged them immensely, more than anybody can realize. Only hindsight can only reveal that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
You know, we kind of got a little history and a background on Tampa and the South Florida mob and how they connect to all the other mob families in the United States. Now let's move on up the coast to your most recent book, New Jersey. Kind of, I didn't really know much about it. We haven't done any stories on New Jersey. I should pay more attention to it because it's probably in the popular culture, New Jersey mafia is more popular in
popular culture.
In popular culture. Yeah, I'm like getting my words doubled up there, but yeah, more well-known in popular culture than anything, mainly because of The Sopranos, probably. But it goes way back to, really, I mean, Atlantic City and Prohibition, and because, you know, Prohibition was, the Apalachin exposure started them on a downhill slide, I'd say, but Prohibition started them on the uphill slide from being these brutal gangsters, that black-handers that preyed on their compadres and their countrymen from Italy and shopkeepers, to becoming the modern criminal syndicate that made a ton of money. So let's talk a little bit. I noticed in your book, the early history, you mentioned Dutch Schultz and the Newark mob.
Yeah, so, you know, Dutch Schultz was kind of a well-known gangster at the time. He operated out of New York City. He was known as a beer baron, very popular very well known to the press during Prohibition. He was kind of like one of those larger than life characters. He wasn't well liked by a lot of the other mobsters. He threatened Thomas Dewey, who's a New York City prosecutor at the time. He rubbed Lucky Luciano the wrong way. And
one of the great like mob hits of all time is the hit on Dutch Schultz, which happened at the Palace Chop House in Newark, New Jersey. The building no longer there, but right in downtown Newark. And he was, in 1935, he was eating there with a couple bodyguards, and some gunmen came in, started shooting up the place, and it you know, has this famous picture of Dutch Schultz kind of slumped over the of the table, bleeding out, and he actually lived for a while afterwards. He brought him to the hospital. But the killing of Dutch Schultz is one of those things that it's kind of jumped over into pop culture a little bit. There was the there's a movie many years ago, Billy Bathgate, about Dutch Schultz with Dustin Hoffman in it. He's been in other movies, The Cotton Club, the movie Hoodlum. He was played by Tim Roth. So he's become kind of one of those gangsters that, of that era, that's kind of transcended who he really was to become a little bit of a, you know, kind of a name in pop culture. In fact, I was talking to a friend the other day on Facebook who worked right across the street from where the Palace Chop House used to be, and they're putting up condos there now as the area is starting to gentrify. And he says it'd be kind of fitting if they called the condos the Dutchman.
We've had this discussion before about the nicknames and you know, do they get them from their fellow gangsters or from something growing up, or does the press give them nicknames? And then the ones with really cool nicknames seem to go on and be more well remembered. So Dutch Schultz is kind of rolls off your lips, and it's kind of a cool name for a gangster.
Oh yeah, I mean his real name was Arthur Flegenheimer, so that Dutch Schultz definitely rolls off the tongue a little bit quicker.
Who wants to say Flegenheimer?
Yeah.
Or have a mobster known whose name is Arthur.
Flegenheimer?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? You think they're going to put that in the press? Flegenheimer. Sounds like a crime you commit.
Really? Then there was another buddy of his that kind of moved on after his, Longie Zillman.
Longie Zillman is a really an interesting character, and I knew a little bit about him before I started researching and more about reading him and you know, talking to some people that had stories about him. He was really a couple things. First of all, he was kind of a folk hero in the Third Ward of Newark, which was a heavily Jewish area. One of the things they used to do back in the 1930s was used to kind of protect the local merchants against, you know, roving gangs. And later with Meyer Lansky, they would actually break up meetings of the Bund in America, which was kind of a Nazi affiliated group. This was a pre-World War II. But the thing about Longie Zillman is he really made his career with Prohibition. That's how he made his money. But he also parlayed it very successfully into political corruption and into legitimate business. He had a host of businesses that he invested money into, everything from a yeast company to a record company to all different kind of businesses, automobiles, pretty much any type of factory or business he invested money in. And of course, bars and restaurants, like a lot of gangsters did. He also nurtured some interesting talent like Jerry Katina, who became a, you know, powerful crime figure in the Genovese family. And Longie Zillman held sway over New Jersey for a really long time without really getting into too much trouble with the law or too much trouble with other mobsters. There was kind of a small skirmishes back and forth between him and Richie the Boot Boyardo back in the early years. But he really kind of kept himself out of the fray. And even when law enforcement came after, most of the time was for things like tax evasion. He is also remembered as one of probably the only gangsters that, or very few gangsters, I'll say, that killed himself. And that's how he died in 1959, as he hung himself in his house in New Jersey.
That's interesting. Yeah, the only other gangster I've heard of, there's probably others, were Frank Nitti, who shot himself. He was getting ready. He was going to have to go back to the penitentiary, and they said he had extreme claustrophobia, and he just couldn't take it anymore. So that is unusual. Usually, you know, their thoughts turn to homicide rather than suicide. That's what I'm always teasing my wife about. You know, when I get a little bit down, my thoughts turn to homicide. Some people, their thoughts turn to suicide.
So. I'm going to have to remember that. Make sure that Gary gets a Father's Day card.
Yes. You can ask people I've worked with. Anyhow, moving right along.
Wait a second. Here was something interesting on him, on Zwillman, from Wikipedia, that he had dated Jean Harlow.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I didn't see that one. He dated a movie actor.
Yeah. That was a... Yeah, he dated Jean Harlow. But again, he was one of those guys that, you know, he's very well known to his local community, but, outside that, he wasn't very well known. In fact, nowadays, if you put, the name of a top 20 mobsters that people would be familiar with, he wouldn't be one of those. Yet he was probably one of the more influential New Jersey-based racketeers for a few decades there, at least.
But he didn't have a cool name like Dutch Schultz.
Dutch Schultz or Albert Anastasia. He didn't even need a nickname, Lord High Executioner. But just having a name like Albert Anastasia was enough, I think. It's like Mickey Mantle. I mean, he's got to be a baseball player. So he would have controlled all the booze that came in along the coast. And probably, you've got close access, immediate access to New York City with huge population in place waiting, wanting to drink booze. And then you've got this coastline all along Jersey, all the way down to Atlantic City, which would be pretty open to bringing in booze. So I would imagine that a lot of, he was instrumental and worked with the New York families, probably why he got along with everybody, because he helped them make money bringing booze in from England and Canada.
Yeah. And, his sphere of influence was more the northern Jersey, like Raritan Bay, the upper part of the coast. Of course, you have the Atlantic City influence on the southern part. But yeah, you do have not only the coastline in the front, but you have the bays in the back. You have like the Navincent, Shrewsbury River, Barnegat Bay, like I said, Raritan Bay with all the associated little, the Passaic River and the Newark Bay. So there's a lot of these areas that were perfect for bootlegging. And you would have boats that would park offshore, and then people would go out of port towns like Perth Amboy or the Atlantic Highlands and take these little super fast skiffs out there and unload off the mothership, if you will. So it became a very, very common occurrence on the Jersey Shore during Prohibition to see this going on. And the Coast Guard was really understaffed and under-equipped to deal with just the sheer volume of stuff that was coming in offshore, and that's not even touching the independent distillery operations that were going on at the time.
Well, it's a little bit like some of the narcotic smuggling today. We were once working. We had in Kansas City. We had the L.A. gangs were expanding out of Southern California because there was so much competition among themselves. And crack cocaine was starting to get popular in the Midwest. And they told us at one time that DEA, I think, had some kind of a highly placed informant. They would send out waves of people on the airplanes with, some people would have 3 or 4 kilos. This was before, there was so much security and so much checking of luggage and looking through everybody's stuff and all that. And they would just send out waves of people. And some of them would look real obvious. And they would not have anything, and then there'd be 4 or 5 people on a plane, and maybe 2 of them would have, that didn't look obvious, would have, 10 or 15 kilos on them when they first got started. So it's, anytime you're getting involved in smuggling and there's a huge demand and there's a lot of people willing to make a little bit of money to do that, it's easy to overwhelm law enforcement and continually try to trick them.
Oh, interesting.
So, as long as Zwillman, who was Jewish, sounds like, of course, and I think he has a really long, unpronounceable name, if I remember right. No, I'm thinking of Jaime Weiss. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Jaime Weiss. He's this Jewish guy that's kind of running all the rackets in Newark and on just across from New York City, and he's able to make money for the New York families eventually, and he kills himself. Now, eventually, I believe a Sicilian-born person is going to take over. Would that be this Angelo Gip Di Carlo? Was he kind of the next iteration of the mob in Newark and New Jersey area?
Well, he was one of them. There wasn't any really one major figure that kind of emerged out of that. But he had a few. He had Richie the Boot Boyardo,
You had guys like Jip DiCarlo. You had Jerry Katina. Jip DiCarlo was located more up in Hudson County. Jerry Katina was out of Newark, and Richie Boyardo was out of Newark. What was the thing that tied those guys together, and the thing that kind of made them all pretty powerful, is they were part of the same crime family, the Genovese family. And in New Jersey, you have the homegrown DeCavalcante family. You had a lot of Lucchese guys, but the Genovese family were probably one of the more powerful ones, and they were certainly one of the more powerful of the New York crime family. So that influence definitely extended into New Jersey.
So when the Sopranos show them being kind of like a subset of a New York City crime family, then that's really based in fact. It sounds like the New Jersey had to be some kind of had to be connected. It's a little bit like Milwaukee and Kansas City are to Chicago. Chicago is the big duck. Each family operates somewhat separately, but not without, they can't do a whole lot without some kind of permission from Chicago. I remember I was listening to a wiretap of our crime boss, Nick Savella, talking to his underboss, Tuffy DeLuna, about whether they could call this guy Lefty Rosenthal out in Las Vegas without talking to Joey Iupa first. And they had this big, long discussion, and finally they decided that had already been decided in a meeting a year or so before, that if Kansas City needed to talk to Lefty, they could do it. So they did it. But it was pretty important. It sounded like they operated with the New York family exactly the same way.
What's interesting about Jersey, so you had the five New York families that had crews operating in New Jersey. You had the DeCavalcante family, which was a small homegrown family based out of Elizabeth, New Jersey. Then you had the Bruno guys out of Philly in South Jersey. So, you have definitely had a lot going on in the state.
I forgot about that. That's for sure. Philly had Atlantic City, didn't they, in some ways?
Yeah, they definitely had a big influence there in the Atlantic City and throughout South New Jersey.
Well, and didn't there was kind of a connection between the New Jersey families and Philadelphia, because it was right there on the Jersey border, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, in neighborhoods like, towns like Cherry Hill, and certainly the South areas like Margate, Atlantic City, you had Philly guys that not only operated out of there, but lived there. You had Philly guys that lived in Trenton. You had Phil, they belonged to the Bruno family, but they lived in South Jersey. That was kind of their bedroom community, if you will.
So here's a question I got, Scott, and I noticed you've got, I think, a whole chapter in your books about the DiCarlo tapes, and I've always heard of these. They were unauthorized. This was when the FBI was tapping phones and recording conversations and, reporting on them and writing reports on them and hide them in their files. Before the 1968 Omnibus Crime Control Act, in which the federal government started regulating wiretapping and electronic communication interception under the law, before it was, there was not exactly a law against it or a law for it that allowed for it. So they threw these wiretaps up, and these are pretty well known. I've heard of these for a long time. What kind of stuff did they talk about?
One of the cool things that came out of my research on this is, and it was towards the end of my research, I was visiting a source, and I was getting ready to leave, and he had a box, and he said, I don't know if I have any need for these. Would you be interested? And the box were the original FBI transcripts of the DiCarlo tapes.
Wow.
About almost 50 pounds, the box, because I shipped it back to Florida. I didn't have a chance to go in depth through all of them, but I was able to look through some of them and incorporate that into the book. And I think it would be a great future book. The interesting things about these tapes is what you would probably expect, that there are some interesting nuggets of information there, talking about other guys, what they owe each other. But it's buffered in a lot of just BS, talking about what's on television, what's going on with the world. But it's fascinating because it gives an insight into how mundane and quite frankly boring a lot of the days were for these guys. If they weren't out doing scores or they weren't out doing something with purpose, they just basically hung around and shot the shit, if you will, for lack of a better term. One of the interesting conversations I saw was they were watching the Valachi hearings on television and talking about what a scumbag this guy is, and you know, all he's saying is, but then they would be like, oh, well, yeah, he mentioned this guy or he mentioned that guy. So they were at one hand mad that they were being exposed on television, but at the second point, they were eager to hear if somebody's name was going to be mentioned. So kind of funny.
They are human beings. That's the thing. Those, I've got a whole bunch of wiretaps from the Strawman investigation where they uncovered the skim coming out of Las Vegas to Kansas City and Chicago. And you're right. It's just a lot of mundane stuff, but it does humanize them and kind of let you know that, like one Carl DeLuna's talking to Tony Spilotro in Vegas. And he had this, they had really coded stuff, and you couldn't figure out what it was. And then Tuffy made a comment about his Mugari, which is in Sicilian's wife, and Spilotro says, what? And Tuffy says, oh, I forgot, you don't speak Italian. Yeah, that's my wife. So, you know, just little things like that that are hilarious.
I was going to say, there's an interesting tie. You mentioned Spilotro. There's an interesting little tie between Spilotro and a New York mobster by the name of Little Pussy Russo, Anthony Russo. Anthony Russo owned for a short time in the late 70s the Jolly Trolley, which is now the Bonanza gift shop on the North Strip in Las Vegas. And he was killed in Long Branch in the late 1970s. One of the interesting things about that was that one of the stories that I heard from an underworld source, and again, being from an underworld source, this could just be a bunch of guys talking, thinking that this is what happened, but that Russo got into a beef with Spilotro at the Jolly Trolley casino there in Vegas and Chicago. Russo wasn't well liked by the Genovese family anyway, and Chicago asked if they would do a favor, and in 1979 Russo was killed in his house in Long Branch. But I just thought it was always kind of an interesting theory, and it might just be nothing more than mob gossip, but I sometimes find that stuff interesting where they, you know, the stories you won't hear in the newspaper, the right. FBI reports.
Somebody needs to write this down. Questions to ask Frank Culotta.
Yeah, well, Frank Culotta might know about that.
Yeah, if there you go.
Yankees mob tour, he may know something about that. Part of all of our fascination with the mafia, organized crime, La Cosa Nostra, whatever you want to call it, is these connections and these rules that they have and how they operate within a certain structure, and they, for the most part, they respect that structure, just like Nick and Tuffy talking about whether they could even call and talk to Frank DeLuna, or I mean Frank Rosenthal, Lefty Rosenthal, without getting Chicago's permission. It was, and they mentioned that several times about different mob protocol things. I think that's part of our fascination, that they break the law in any other way, but yet they have their own internal rules that they follow rigidly.
Yeah, yes, the politics of La Cosa Nostra, I think, and to some extent probably still keep it, but kept it a viable organization as opposed to many other street gangs or other types of organized crime syndicates that don't have that in place.
Yeah, it is different. So
yeah, just don't catch a case.
Don't catch a case.
No, I had a question before we move on here really quickly. You got 50 pounds of paperwork or 50 pounds of cassettes?
It was paperwork. It was the old original. It's in the original FBI, like Manila binders, if you will, and there's little notes, and I actually found a couple placeholders were little matchbooks from restaurants in New Jersey that are long gone. So
probably mafia bilia.
Kind of a cool find.
Yeah, well, it would have been a cool find.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking if that was an audio tape, man, you could send us one and we would do like a bonus episode. We just rip that as a file and play it back, but no.
Are those audios out there anywhere? Did anybody ever snag the audio or digitalize it or anything?
I don't think so.
I've never
heard of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of the problem is that was so long ago, and then they passed that law and everybody went kind of underground in the federal government when it came to, I think it was Senator Long from Missouri, and he actually did this at the behest of Jimmy Hoffa. Went around and had hearings, and some of our guys in the intelligence unit had to go down and testify at a hearing in the, I want to say, early 60s about illegal wiretapping, which was, you know, it was illegal. It wasn't illegal, but it wasn't legal. And they were trying to find out the extent of it, Congress was. And it was really Hoffa worrying about Bobby Kennedy is what one of the old-time detectives told me. But they were all shitting bricks that they had to go down and talk about if they tapped any phones and whose phones they tapped and what they did with the information.
Wow.
So it's all in the game, as they say in The Wire. It's all in the game, yo. Those guys, they had one guy. God, I can't remember his name. He had retired when I came into the unit, but they had one guy who was like the electronics genius and did all the wiretapping back in the '50s and sixties up until, again, like I said, till 1968 when they made it, put criminal penalties on wiretapping and, interception of electronic communications. I went back in the back room and found all the old devices that they used to use. Tried to make them work, but I never could make them work. And it's probably a good thing. I was a young policeman. I'd have got myself in the penitentiary. In modern times, I guess, you see a little bit out of the New York family. There was just a case with working with this skinny Joe Merlino out of Philly doing some kind of scams and some of the, was it Genovese, that Patsy, God, I can't, all of a sudden I've lost his last name, Pasquale, I think, took a hit for something, but what's your opinion of the modern family up there in the Northeast area and also down in Southern Florida? What's going on today?
Starting with the South Florida, the, Tampa area is pretty much non-existent anymore. With Tampa was interesting. It's not so much law enforcement efforts as it's just general attrition. A lot of the sons of the older guys didn't go into the family business, and it just kind of petered itself out for the most part. There was very little, you know, there was some law enforcement involvement with the decline, but it was really much more of an assimilation type thing. Now, South Florida itself, the Miami area, long ago, most of the wise guys moved up to Palm Beach and Broward County, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach areas. And there's still activity there. You mentioned, you know, Joe Merlino lives in Boca Raton now. The Northeast, really, it's kind of interesting because New York and New Jersey areas, there's still stuff going on. It's not what it was for sure, even 25 years ago. But there's always a part of me that's like, I can't believe we're in 2017 and we're still talking about the five New York mafia families. And it's been, you know, law enforcement's been after them for decades, but there's still a resiliency there and there's still a presence, albeit a much smaller presence in the Northeast.
You know, I kind of a little, maybe not exactly on the subject question. I just met a guy at who is the pro at the golf club where I play golf, and another guy said, you know, did you know he used to be a Miami-Dade County copper who actually investigated Cuban organized crime down there? His name is David Shanks. So I introduced myself and started talking to him, and he had written a book actually about a Bolito investigation that he had been involved in, and also had some narcotics and gambling and loan sharking implications for a Cuban organized crime family. And he said he ended up, he wrote the book and then he couldn't, you know, since he's like me writing a book, you know, it's really hard to sell it unless you go out and sell it yourself. And he ended up sending it to this, true crime author, TJ English, who I'm sure you probably know and certainly have heard of.
Oh yeah. No, TJ Law.
And So now that book's getting ready to come out, and I got to get David on the show, called The Corporation. And it's about this guy's investigation. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah. Yes, very much. I know TJ.
I'm going to have.
And I actually sent him. Yeah. We talked a little bit because obviously there's some ties too with the Cubans and Traficante. And then even in New Jersey, you know, Union City, New Jersey was a very, very big headquarters for the Cuban Corporation. And, I can't wait for that. That's going to be the first real good book on that subject, so that's going to be really good to read.
Yeah, I tell you what, I about died when I started talking to this guy and asking about his career, and he worked organized Cuban organized crime, and then retired, and we came and worked for the feds as a, I don't know, for their strike force or some kind of a task force they had, as a, you know, they take on retired policemen and give them federal commissions and working those task force now. And he did that. Then he retired from that and moved to Kansas City and became the golf pro at the National Country Club. Go figure that one. He's a great golfer.
Seems a lot safer than living in, you know, Florida as a retired agent like that.
Really?
Now, kind of interesting. I'm just looking at the Wikipedia, and it's interesting that Sam the Plumber ends up pleading guilty to operating gambling rackets and turning over $20 million a year. This, of course, going back, and then they kind of decimated the New Jersey family in all of that, taking down a lot of associates, which seems to me to make sense why the New York families would move in even more.
Yeah, the Cavalcante family was always small to begin with, and starting in the early 90s, there was quite a bit of law enforcement pressure put on them. The interesting thing about Sam the Plumber, that's how the family got its name, the Cavalcante family. They were known as the Elizabeth family prior to that. Is after he got out of jail in the late 1970s, he abdicated the throne and moved to Miami Beach into a condo on Collins Avenue. And he's actually one of the few mobsters that died a free man and lived a long time. He died in 1997, I believe, in Miami Beach. But his successor, John Riggi, was arrested and sentenced to prison in the 1990s. That kind of started the downfall of the DeCalvacante family. In fact, just a couple of years ago, there was a big bust. Part of it was out in Vegas as well with members of the Elizabeth crime family, and knocked arrested a capo and a couple members of the family. I think that was back in 2016. They were sentenced to prison. So the family's still active, but it's much diminished from its power back in the day.
Tell the folks a little bit more about your Tampa mob tour. Remind everybody about, you know, we probably got some snowbirds up here. They'll be on their way to South Florida anyhow. Tell everybody about your mob tour. How did they find out about it, and what do they do? And
yeah, so one of the interesting things I do is run a Tampa Mafia walking tour of the old Ybor City neighborhood. We do it once a month in the fall and spring. We do not do it in the summer because it is 95 degrees with 100% humidity. Not fun for a walking tour. But anyone could find out about it if you go to Cigar City Magazine, which is an online magazine about Tampa history. If you go to the events page, you can find out all the information on the mob tour there. That's cigarcitymagazine.com.
All right, great. Your website, go over that again, and your Twitter and your Facebook.
Sure. My website is scottditchie1word.com. That's scottditchie.com. My Facebook page, look, type in my name. I have an author page, Scott Ditchie Author. And my Twitter handle is scottyyz.
All right, great. And we will put links up to your books, the most recent book that we've talked about, Garden State Gangland, The Rise of the Mob in New Jersey, is on pre-release right now, but it's going to be out. Actually, by the time this is up, it will be out. So we'll have links on the blog page to all your books and to your website,
great,
and all that. So, God, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and it's been great talking to you. Aaron's over there holding up his finger.
I just want to make sure that we reminded everybody, if you've listened to the entire episode, that what you want to do if you happen to be in Las Vegas on March 15th is head on down to the Mob Museum, because Scott is going to be there for a special event speaking, signing his book, and then again on March 16th, he will be at the Mob Museum as well to sign more of his books.
Oh, great. I apologize. I forgot about that. And folks, take that Mob Museum tour while you're there. It is fantastic. It's really, I was impressed.
Yes,
I was really impressed. They put top quality stuff in there, and it's, what, four floors, I think, of mob memorabilia and information. It's unbelievable. Scott, I actually gave them some of the wiretaps that I got so they could have so get some audio from the straw man case in their little corner back there about the skimming from Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s.
I did listen to that. That's right. Those were really good. And I actually gave him a bunch of mug shots as well. So actually on that wall near the wiretaps where they have the mug shots of those guys, most of them are actually Tampa guys.
Oh, really?
So I think we're in the same exhibit together.
Well, sounds like we are.
Small world.
You know, Mike Green, Mike Green from UNLV. He's
absolutely.
I flew out and interviewed some for my movie. I flew out and interviewed some FBI agents who had worked the case, but also interviewed Mike Green as a, you know, professional historian expert, and he had a lot of personal experiences. He's a good guy. I really liked him.
Yeah, I like talking to Mike. Yeah.
And we got to remember, folks, if you get a chance to, you want to go get the other book that Scott has, Cocktail Noir.
You can drink like you're favorite gangster or your favorite
drink like a gangster. Absolutely.
Like a gangster. You know, most of the gangsters I knew that were really good ones, they mainly drank coffee and soda. They were not big drinkers. You know, you don't survive long in that world if you're much of a big drinker, but
no, but you know, one of the funny things was real quick is, you know, I'm talking to some of these relatives of the old gangsters and like reading stuff in old FBI reports, and a lot of the old mobsters, guys like Lansky, they didn't drink a lot of top shelf stuff. They would drink like J&B Scotch or Cutty Sark or they definitely didn't go for the single malt stuff. That's for sure.
Oh yeah, a lot of the good ones, and they'll have real humble looking homes and ordinary looking cars. All of our guys did, and they could have had a lot more. But you know, keep that low profile and don't spend any money that you don't have to. Hell, I understand that. I live
exactly
the same way.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Scott, this has been great. We look forward.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
Maybe meeting you one of these days and keep up the faith and keep up the good work in documenting the organized crime in the United States. You do a good job.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye, Scott.
Have a good one.
Thank you. I start pulling up the Wikipedia on some of these guys, and, you know, there's a lot of detail that the Wikipedia has that we didn't cover.
No,
so
not.
I can't imagine how much information he's got packed into these books.
Oh, he's got a ton packed into. He could go back and do five more episodes, one on each one of his books.
I mean, I felt like I was kind of spitballing him a little bit there, just kind of throwing out these things just off the Wikipedia, and he just picked it right up and was like, he knew his stuff.
Yeah, he knew every fact, didn't he? That guy's he has got it going on, and I can imagine. I've got to get this, particularly this. I'm really more interested in the South Florida Tampa book. I need to get that one first. I'll probably end up getting the Atlantic's the New Jersey book, but I want to get up on this South Florida thing a little more because, you know, we're going to interview this retired officer David Shanks, who's the golf pro, about the Cuban Bolito investigation he was involved in. That's going to be a book and has had a screenplay sold too. The name of the book is The Corporation. It's on presale out there now, folks, by a real well-known true crime author, T.J. English. And I talked with Scott about that. I don't need to go over that.
You never know who you're going to run into playing golf.
We used to follow those mob guys once in a while out to the golf course, but we never played along behind them.
Did you ever play in front of them?
No, we never went out and played while they were playing. Now, up in Chicago, Bill Romer and some of his FBI agents did, when they did this Operation Lockstep on Sam Giancana, they did follow in the foursome directly behind Giancana and his foursome, and they would drive up into their foursome with their golf balls. And then Giancana went to court and complained and tried to get a restraining order against the FBI for following him around too close. And they did get an order that said they had to stay at least one foursome behind the mobsters. Now, I'll tell you one interesting story, and I won't ever say this name because I don't think it's fair. We did have a Major League Baseball umpire out playing golf with Tony Ripesavella and I believe Willie Camisano and one other Kansas City mob guy made up the foursome. And he was a gambler, too. So You know, and I know that we reported that to the FBI, and then the FBI went to Major League Baseball, and he was given a talking to, and we never saw anything like that again.
He didn't go play any more golf with those guys.
I don't think he probably ever played any golf with those guys again.
He didn't go out in public with them.
I don't think it was. You know, they're like us. You know, if you got a chance, the bragging rights to play golf with a major league umpire, if you got that opportunity, you're going to take it. It's not that you're out to you know, fix Major League Baseball games, although they're always capable of doing that, but you're going to take that chance.
They're always preying on human weakness.
Yes, they are.
To take advantage of a situation. And certainly if you're an umpire and you have a gambling problem.
Yeah. And you know, you get taken for about $25,000 on the golf course with some mobsters. Why? Yeah. You might call a ball a strike and a strike a ball if it makes a difference for them, but nobody believed this guy ever did that. He had connections in Kansas City, family connections, and we believe that's why he was out playing golf with them. He probably didn't he may not even known who they were exactly. It probably were represented to him as just local businessmen, friends of friends or something. Do my public service announcement. If you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to purchase for $7. That's it, $7. You can own it, watch it over and over and over again because there's details and clips and interviews from the mouth of the men that did it and the mouth of the men that brought them down.
And,
and
special features.
Yeah. Well, are the special features on the Amazon?
Oh, wait a minute. They probably aren't on the on the digital download. You've got to get the DVD to get these special features. And I've got one interview with a Las Vegas policeman that'll knock your socks off. So,
so put on an extra pair of socks. And what you want to do is give a $25 donation. Put a hit out on our donate button. And Gary, as long as you're in the United States, we'll send you a copy of the DVD with those outtakes and extras. Then you want to get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour, for $1.99. You can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And if that's not enough, Gary's got a book out now called Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Transcribing the words from the mouth of the men that did it. Gary also has the Kindle version with hyperlinks to video files with the audio transcribed as well from the mouth of the men that did it. Ganglandwire.com. Download, share, subscribe, and support. The work that we do here is good. We need your help to make this happen week after week.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Good night, everybody.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Hi, Scott. Gary Jenkins.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Hey, Gary.
Good. How you doing?
Doing well.
Good.
Doing well.
Is it nice and warm down there? And it's where are you at? You're in St. Petersburg, aren't you? St. Pete's.
Yep. Yeah, it's nice down here today.
This is what you Floridians live for, is the winter, isn't it? Then you can laugh at us up north while we're freezing our butts off.
I grew up in New Jersey. My wife's from Chicago.
So you guys, your wife really knows. That's Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely.
It doesn't ever warm up. It doesn't seem like until about July.
Yeah, and it gets cold again in September. So.
And then I remember one really hot. I had an aunt that lived up there, and I came in on the train, and I walked out, and it was hot in those, you know, kind of concrete canyons, but I got just around the corner, and the wind came off the lake, and it just, you know, dropped about 25 degrees.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right, we're getting
how
all,
are you doing?
We're getting all lined up here, and
you want to have him do the liner?
Okay.
Yeah. One thing, I'd like to get my guest to do like a one liner. You would say this is Scott M. Deitch or Scott D. Is it Deitch? Is that how you pronounce that?
Deitch.
Yeah, this is Scott Deitch, and you might like my most recent book on organized crime, Garden State Gangland, The Rise of the Mob in New Jersey, and you're listening to Gangland Wire. Could you? And then we'll put it. I'll put that every once in a while. I have them from most of my guests, and I'll plug them in when I do another show sometime after we do yours, just as a lead in for the show.
Yeah, I can do that. Just let me know whenever you're ready.
All right, go ahead.
This is Scott Deitch. Hold on. I'm sorry. Oh, hold on. I dropped the phone. Okay. Start again. Ready?
That was great. I'll use that a couple, three times probably throughout the year. Kind of gives you, reminds people you got that book out there. We always like to help our guests that have books out there to get the word out and do, of course, the social media marketing. That's where I first learned about you was on social media and the world of the Tampa Mafia and your mob tour down there.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing little tool, isn't it, for free even?
Oh, I know. It's great. It's great. It's,
you actually take people out on your tour, right? Do you do that? Or something?
Yeah, I do it personally. We do it once a month. I work with a... Well, we don't do it in the summer because it's too darn hot.
It's funny. They don't do it here in the winter because it's too cold.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, it's been successful. Been doing it for quite a number of years now. So I really enjoy it.
It's really interesting. Here in Kansas City, we have one that's part of another tour company, and they hire a guy who's an actor, basically, and he has kind of a pattern. You know, he's got his regular things that he does. He does mainly 30 stuff. And they don't really advertise it. Doesn't seem it could be popular if they'd advertise it more, I think. And then a friend of mine started a streetcar tour. We've got a new streetcar that's free, and he was doing tours and he wanted to do a mob tour. And most of the stuff is downtown. He was consulting with me about it and what he should talk about and what would be important. And he was complaining about having to rent a bus every time. And I said, well, heck, why don't you do a streetcar tour and just advertise it on Facebook? He's a young guy trying to get something going. And so he did it, and he could keep the price way down because he didn't have to rent that bus. And it's just him. So he started getting, 15 people every Friday night. He'd get 15 people that would show up at one of the streetcar stops and take him on the mob tour.
It was a walking tour.
Yeah, it was a walking tour. They'd walk to one stop, and he'd get off, and he'd walk them around and talk about different mob sites and then get back on. Then, of course, Frank Culotta's got his out in Las Vegas, and then now Frank Calabrese Jr.'s got his up in Chicago. So.
Yeah, I was talking to Frank. I'm going to be out in Vegas twice this year for events at the museum, and I want to take his tour. Yeah, I just saw Frank Calabrese's. I like to take it. You know, I did the Untouchables tour up there. It was nice, but I don't like the whole acting.
Right, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Spiel. I just want, just tell me straight, I mean, I don't need a guy dressed up in a fedora and talking exactly. Like he's coming out of a, 30s movie or something.
Yeah, they had the Tropicana tried doing kind of a mob history museum for a while, and I went out to the guy had something called the Crime Con a few, 2000 and, I don't know, 14, maybe 13 and 14. He did it 2 years, and he couldn't really make any money. And I went out and showed my movie and took questions and they took us on the Tropicana mob tour. And that's what they had was about three or four actors hired, which makes it really expensive if you start hiring those actors.
Yeah.
To
exactly.
do that. And yeah. I, I'm with you, Scott. I didn't really like it. It just seemed phony and fake to me. I'd rather have, somebody that really knew the history. They really knew the history. And of course, Frank Culotta and Frank Calabrese, they had their own little, je ne sais quoi, shall we say, the little something extra that none of the rest of us could ever, mimic that.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Like, I think he definitely him and Frank Calabrese definitely have that that part down pat.
They've got that realistic edge that none of us can get. I mean,
yeah,
Gary has one, and he's been to the Mob Museum in Spoke before, because I don't know how well you can hear me. I'm kind of on the other side of the wall at the moment, but
I'm having trouble hearing your co-host. Is that
I'm going to come around here.
He's over at the board. He needs to come.
Around. Yeah, but. Frank Calabrese and Frank Culotta both have made their bones.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I've done a few. I do one. I'm on the board of the Jackson County Historical Society, and so we have a fundraiser every year, and I offer my services to take them around and do a mob tour with me explaining, you know, what the sites were and what they're looking at and what's happened there, and I can throw some of my own experiences in there and. From the 70s kind of mob stuff. And it's always hugely popular. But you know what's funny? It was only the first year that the people actually showed up. they'll donate like $500 to do it. And then they never cash it in. I did that for another friend of mine's a fundraiser for a private high school. And I said, oh yeah, I'll do it. I'll throw in a copy of my movie and I get a copy of this FBI agent's book from him and throw those in as part of the package. And they offered as a fundraiser, but people don't usually show up. I think they're a little bit afraid to when it comes down to it. Yeah, sounds like a good idea at the time. You got people that don't show up.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, just for like the, like I'll do exactly the same thing for charity. And, yeah, I'd say like one out of three will take cash that in. But anyway,
and I've had a couple of people that wanted to do it. And I said, you know, you got to pay me for this. They want to do it as a little deal for their staff at their law office. For example, one guy was a lawyer in a big law firm. But, you know, I don't know. They never come around and
Quinn and Peebles
decide they're going to do it. Hell, Quinn and Peebles, no. That was long gone. That was an old mob law firm, Quinn and Peebles. No, this is like Shepwell or one of the big silk stocking firms there. And
yeah.
Here's a question for Scott. He mentioned that he's going to be at the, and we'll probably recover this too in the recording set, that he's going to be at the Mob Museum twice this coming year.
Yeah.
Do you know the dates?
Do you know the dates of that Mob Museum?
Well, one of them is actually for an appearance. The other one, I was named to the advisory board last year, so I'll be gone after that. But my appearances will be on March 15th. I'll be doing a speaking engagement, and March 16th, I'll be doing a book signing.
Okay. All right. 2 days in a row. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll make sure we get those.
I'll be back out in April, back out in April, they're supposed to do something with the advisory board, maybe potentially an event, but that's not been set in stone yet.
Okay. So,
but I just set the agreement to do the ones in March the other day.
The 15th and the 16th. Okay, cool. I don't know. Is there anything?
Ready, Aaron?
Yeah.
And of course, here's what, you know, kind of the usual kind of a stick. I know you've done these before is, we've got to turn down the mics in a minute. And he plays a little lead in music just so we get the feel of a live show. It's not really, I'll take this home and edit it and put it out. I'll let you know. I'll give you at least a couple of weeks advance notice when I'm going to put it out. I've got a whole bunch of them right now that I'm putting together and getting it lined up on into the new year. So, it won't like come out this next week. And if you want to try to make it coordinate with something, I see your book's on pre-sale right now, but I think it's due out pretty quick, and then the 16th.
Yeah, the 16th.
Yeah, yep. I've already got something scheduled. I told these people I'd put out for the next 2 weeks, so it'll be after your book goes out. But anyhow, we'll talk a little bit about you and talk about your contact information, and then I want to. You know, maybe go back into kind of the South Florida Mafia in general, because, you know, our fans like, you know, they like that. They're mafia wonks, I would say. They like those details. And then go in more specifics about your book. I made some notes here, like the Dutch Schultz and the New York mob, how kind of that developed a little bit. And now I wouldn't mind talking about the DiCarlo tapes. I've always heard of the DiCarlo tapes and those are pretty interesting. A lot of people know about those. So those are kind of the main things. And we would like to talk about and anything else, you know, that comes to mind you think is interesting stories out of your book. Why, you know, we can go there too.
Okay.
All right, Aaron, you about ready?
Sounds good. Yeah, one other thing I want to just clarify. I'm sorry, it's March 15th is the book signing. And the event is Friday, March 16th. A speaking engagement on the 15th and the book signing, an additional book signing on the 16th. So I just verified that. I just pulled up my contract.
Okay. You'll be talking.
All right, I'm ready to go.
You're talking on the 15th and then signing books after, and then on the 16th is just a book signing.
Yep, exactly.
Okay. All right.
Okay, Aaron, you ready?
Yep.